You're listening to Ryan Anderson's Model Railcast Show with your hosts, Craig Bisgeier and Tim Harrison. We're bringing you the latest news, reviews, and interviews on the hobby of model railroading. The Model Railcast Show, keeping you on the right track.
All right, Model Railcasters, I'm pretty sure this is going to be show 219. It depends on how my editing goes. Bob, you're one of a couple shows that I've got recorded, or will be recording, so then I just need to find the time to sit down and edit them. But as you can, Model Railcasters, tell, I've got with me Bob Sprague. And Bob, do you prefer Bob or Robert, or do you not care?
I don't care what you call me, just call me, but my friends call me Bob.
So, all right. Well, if it's not too presumptive, we'll count ourselves as your friend then.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Great. And I'm trying to remember the last show. I'm trying to remember if I had you on. I know I've had you on once, but I feel like I've had you on two times, but I can't remember.
Yeah, that's right. We've done it twice. I think we did it maybe a year ago or so, and then probably a year before that.
Yeah, excellent. Well, we're glad to have you back on. I'm glad, Bob, because you're an easy edit, and I keep forgetting that. So, you know.
Well, I've been called easy before, but never an easy edit. So, I'll take it.
Excellent. Well, some quick updates. And I know for me, actually, I've been on the last show. I hadn't been able to get down too much, and since that time, since I last recorded with Craig, which was probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I've been down in the layout room, and. One of my friends is really, really not going to be happy with me until I get some scenery done. He knows I'm into the operations part of the layout, but he's just dying for me to get some kind of scenic work done. And I'm not going to mention any names, Rick Belisatis. So I've realized that there's this part on my railroad. Goes through the residential section of Gloucester City, and there's nothing there. The track just goes through. And so I don't have to worry about really anything not working through there. It's just a plain old track, no sidings, no switches there, just two tracks for about a 10-foot stretch with nothing happening. So that's the area I decided to scenic and basically kind of picking the minds of a few guys, including Jim Lincoln, on just track weathering. And so I basically experimented with some of my acrylics, managed to get a different color for the rail and for the tie plates and for the ties. And use some India ink as well, which really runs really nicely between the cracks and the ties. And then I did the first ballasting that I've done on a railroad in 25 years. That's how long it's been since I had a layout that I could put some scenery on.
Good for you. That's a that's a big step. And ballasting is certainly an art.
Yeah, when you see those guys do it, it's like, wow, it's the hobby's whatever you want it to be. So if really – you know, if all you can do is put down gray rocks. But with me, I'm just looking at the pictures and I'm like, okay, well, it looks like there's definitely lots of color variation going on there. And maybe not dramatically speaking, but color nonetheless. So,
well, I think it's worth the trip. You know, it's been said many times, the track is a model like anything else. And, a little effort to put some color there, get the right colors and have the variation. I mean, I've seen a few pictures of what Jim's doing and, I guess Proto 48,
yeah,
where he's got all the tie plates and every tie seems to be individually weathered and things like that.
Yes.
So if only life was long enough to do that everywhere, that'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the thing, Bob, for me is, you know, as far as I can tell, you know, I'm working on a multi-deck railroad. I'm not building the second deck until I have the first one, tested, maybe about a year's worth of op sessions on it just to make sure. I don't want anything overhead of it until I know it's going to run because I'm just that paranoid.
And that's very wise. I visited a railroad once on an NMRA tour, and the guy made the mistake of ballasting like the day before the show.
Oh.
Everything ran like it was going over a gravel road.
Or so, man.
He was hating life there for a little while.
Well, basically what I wanted to do was come up with a way to weather my track that I could do for all of the, you know what I mean? Cause it's like one thing, well, like Jim Lincoln, he's got that beautiful Proto 48, but it's also a four, foot-long section of track.
Right.
Whereas I'm going to have about, on the first level, about 80, 90 feet of linear track. And to put, I mean, I could put a lot of attention in detail, but I would like to get it done at some point in my lifetime. So just trying to figure out the good enough approach is going to be the key to my success there.
Well, no one's going to be, you know, on a larger layout, stopping and looking at every tie. It's very impressive when Jim's doing it on his relatively small stretch. But, you know, when you're operating, it's like trees.
Yeah.
You might want to have a few that are out in front that are gorgeous, but the great mass of them is going to be just background.
And, yeah. And
again, if you're creating the right impression with the track, I think it's really in the overall color and texture and not in the you know, bit by bit detail.
Right. No, that makes sense to me. So that's what's been going on with me. Some track work, trying to get some stuff, trying to get some models built. I'm going to have a lot of buildings. And so I'm saving for when me and the wife are watching something. I'll bring up one of my models and work on it. I'm also working on building a three-way switch for Bolson Street, the Bolson Street car float. So that's fun in of itself.
Yeah. I saw that on Facebook and looked like you were doing a fabulous job.
Oh, thank you. Usually what I do to help the appearance is to take the picture slightly out of focus so that the mistakes don't come through so well. So
that's a good technique.
So
I'll have to remember that.
But enough from me. Bob, why don't you give us a quick update of what's been going on with you since we talked to you last?
Well, while you're making progress, I'm doing the opposite. I've had to move and so the Annapolis Junction is no longer as it was, and I'm pretty philosophical about it because the fun's in the building, and I have a brand new basement up in Baltimore that I'm going to be moving into, and it has a house on the top of it, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So I guess I'm sort of in the stage right now where we're not going to move in for another month or so, and trying to decide whether I want to sort of take the same concept
right. And
do it in a different space or completely change. And I've had this sort of strange impulse in that the house is that we've settled on is a 1901 house. It's in wonderful shape.
Okay.
But it's got a lot of fabulous 1901 style detail and things like that. And I'm saying, maybe I should go back and have a railroad that's really appropriate for the house. And so instead of my 70s and 80s, chassis models, maybe I need to go back to the 1920s or something like that and have something that really fits the atmosphere, but that's probably just delusions.
It's still a really cool idea. And if you don't mind me going off script for a second real quick, do you find that you're your own, you design layouts, do you find you're your own toughest critic and customer?
I don't know. I actually... you know, designed the one that I have now a while back, and I've been pretty pleased with it.
But oh, great.
I also, it's been interesting to try to build something that I designed and say, yeah, I didn't quite do that as well as I should have. Looked great on paper, but anyway.
Great. So you'll be living in Baltimore then, and then possibly looking into setting up the railroad to match the period of the house. So that's pretty
– Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Well, that's great. Anything else?
Oh, not really. I've work has been definitely interfering with what I'd much rather be doing.
Sure.
I've not been keeping up with some of my designs for the last couple of months, so apologies to those who are waiting, but I'm back on the case now. I've got some good designing done in the last week, so hopefully
excellent.
I'll clear some of the backlog.
Excellent. And when, and maybe you already are, but I would imagine groundwork is being laid for the next MARPM?
Well, it's hopefully a lot more than groundwork. We're really looking forward to this. This will be our next iteration, and it's for those who don't recognize the acronym, it's the Mid-Atlantic Railroad Prototype Modelers Meet. And this year we're on September 30th and October 1st, same location, which is the Wingate by Wyndham in Fredericksburg, Virginia, which is right off of 95, for better or for worse. It's easy to find. It's
right.
Not always easy to get there.
Hey, I found it, so.
That's right. That's right. You did. And we're looking looking to a great time. You know, my end of it is sort of trying to herd the cats that give our clinics, and we've got some of the old favorites coming back, of course, ranging from Lance Mendheim and Bernie Kempinski, and Marty McGurk is coming back this year.
Oh,
and
great.
Ramon Rhodes and Tony Sissons and Dave Emery, who saved our butts last year by stepping in at the last minute and giving some great clinics. And Paul Dulcus, I think, is going to be there as well. And I got some new folks too, like Ben Hom and Doug Chapman, who are gonna be there with really interesting topics. So I'm looking forward to that. And we were very worried that Matt Thompson was going to move himself and take down his Oregon Coast Railway, where he's sponsored operating sessions for the last several years. But he did not move, and it's still there, and he once again is going to open up for us on Thursday night. And if you haven't seen that, and if you haven't operated on Matt's Railroad, you really should make an effort to do that, because it's gorgeous.
So I hear. Sounds like it's really I might just have to see if I can get down a little bit earlier this time, just for stuff like that.
Yeah, you should do that. And the best news of all is that on-site lunches are back.
Oh, yes!
Yeah, Daylene Wolf and Christy are going to serve us up some really good-looking and very healthy food, I should add, on Friday and Saturday at lunchtime, which is kind of nice because there is not a restaurant in the hotel.
Right.
People had to run out to get something, and nobody really wanted to. And so once again, Daylene and Christy are serving up some barbecue on one day, and I forget what on the other day, but it looks good.
Ah, fantastic. And it sounds like you've got a really good stacked deck for presenters there.
Oh, yeah. I think the clinics have been a real highlight. I mean, we've got the models have been outstanding, too, and the vendors and the as you know, the best thing about these things is just wandering around and running into people and talking about model railroading. So it's been a really nice package and a really low pressure, fun, friendly event that I've certainly enjoyed, and the feedback's been tremendous. So I certainly hope everyone who's come before will come again, and some new folks will make their way to Fredericksburg on September 30th.
Excellent. And is there? And you may have said it already, but is there a website?
Oh yes, there is. Cleverly named marpm.org, marpm.org.
Excellent.
And you can register there, of course, and I've got to get it together and post a clinic schedule and things like that, but the big details are there already.
Ah, great. Fantastic. All right.
Three, two, one.
All right. Well, Model Railcasters, starting this roundhouse, privileged to speak to Bob Sprague, and one of the things I like about Bob is that he designs layouts, and I love the type of layouts that he designs because they're the kind that they have the feel of the real thing. They look like they're going to operate like the real thing. And Bob, if I'm a fan of the sincere type layouts, and if I'm not mistaken, you are too. Yes.
Yeah, that's I'm pretty much a stickler about that, and. But it did occur to me, Tim, that some of the listeners might not know what we mean by sincere in a track plan. And it might be good to spend a minute on that because it's pretty fundamental to the way I approach things. But the term was coined, as far as I know, by John Armstrong, who still, as far as I'm concerned, set the bar for track planning. Mm. And he had a great way with words, so... By sincere, what he meant was that the track would go through each scene once and only once. And the reason, of course, is that real railroads don't go around in circles, at least not on purpose. They go from one town to another town, and there's not much reason that they would want to go around in a circle and come back through the same scene twice, except in very rare circumstances. Furthermore, if you're setting up a track plan so that your main line is going from place to place and you are walking along with a train as it proceeds from town to town, from east to west or west to east, you tend to get a much better sense that you're going somewhere, that you're really accomplishing something. And so I certainly go to a lot of trouble to try to make sure that not only does the track proceed through the scene once and only once, but it's in a consistent direction, so that east is always to the right and west is always to the left, or vice versa, and that in general you are not backtracking a lot as you follow a train. So, so yeah, I definitely go for that whenever possible.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I'm sure I probably asked that question later on, but I'm glad we got to it now because I think it really kind of sets the tone for what we'll be talking about, at least a little bit. I'm thinking specifically, Bob, of your article that I just saw in MR, and again, I love the magazine. It's a great magazine. I look forward to it every time it comes. But sometimes I just see these layouts that kind of still have that old spaghetti bowl approach, like what we were talking about. So that's why I have a soft spot for yours, Bob. I'm not objective at all. Your
article, flattery will get you anywhere.
Yeah, that's what I figured. So, but your article in MR addresses a part of model railroading that I actually think doesn't always get a lot of attention, possibly because of the difficult nature and demands, and that's like running big city passenger trains. So I was going to ask you, how well do you think this type of modeling is represented in the hobby? Because I, by no means do I have an exhaustive viewpoint of the hobby.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, there certainly have been some examples of layouts that featured passenger trains in relatively large terminals. But I think just as a lot of modelers model the steam to diesel transition era, a lot of modelers model freight trains. And I think some people think of passenger operations as a little bit monotonous. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a train and it starts at one station and it goes to another station and it stops and you pretend that the little people are getting on and off and then it goes to the next station and that's all there is to it. And if that is all there is to it, it can be pretty dull. But in this particular plan, of course, Mark Goldstein, who I designed this for, and I hope I'm saying his name right, because it could be Goldstein, but it's, I'm going to call him Goldstein, was very determined to model the Toronto terminal area and the Spadina Yard that used to be connected to it. And, you know, sort of implicit in that is a lot of activity. And when you think about it, if you've spent any time around a big city passenger terminal, there are certainly trains coming in, trains going out, but there's also, you know, turning trains, there's breaking up consists and putting them in a different order. There's cleaning and servicing the cars. There's servicing the locomotives. There's, you know, certainly in the grand old days of passenger service, there was a lot of operations where, you know, part of the train would come in from one direction and part would come in from another direction and they'd be, combined, or a sleeper car would be set off on a spur so everybody could go to sleep at a decent hour and it would be added to the train in the middle of the night. There's a lot of variety that can be built into passenger operations if that's what you want to do.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I'm kind of what I suspected a little bit, but some of the difficulties in this type of modeling might be a little obvious. Like in my mind, I would think of those 85-foot cars and the minimum radius. But what are some other difficulties?
Well, I think you put your foot on it, let me start that again. There's a bad edit. You put your finger on it, Tim, in the sense that 85-foot cars are longer than the typical freight car, and the trick there in minimum radius is certainly one of the big measures is that, for instance, you know, if you're an HO and you're running modern 50-foot freight cars, they certainly look better the bigger the radius is, but you can get away down to 24 inches or 26 inches or something like that. And the freight cars, they certainly look better if you're at 30 inches or 36 inches or 42 inches or something like that, but they don't look awful. Now, you take an 85-foot passenger car and try to run it around that same 24-inch curve and hang way out on either side, and you know, it'll operate, but it's not going to look much like the real thing.
Right.
So I usually figure you want to be at 30 inches minimum radius in HO, and probably 16 inches or so for N, if you're going to run a lot of modern passenger equipment. But, you know, the other thing to think about, and I'll plug John Armstrong's book again because it's got some great illustrations about this. One thing that's particularly true about long cars, whether they're passenger cars or freight cars, is that easements into the curves can go a long way toward making things look and operate a lot better. And again, if any of the listeners are not familiar with the idea of an easement, it's something that the prototype railroads do and have to do, but that make models run a lot better as well. And that is that rather than going straight from a tangent or a straight track to a full curve, there's a section where the curve gradually increases in radius or decreases in radius so that you have a smooth transition.
Mm.
And if you sort of look at the geometry of two long cars, if one of them suddenly hits a curve, whether it's 30 inches or bigger, it's going to be at a really big angle to the one that's still on the straight track, and the couplers are going to go and pull against each other, and you know, you're going to get a lot of sideways pressure, which if you're lucky, they'll stay on the track.
You may create your own rotary dumper.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, a smaller radius curve with a nice easement, that alignment will stay a lot more direct in between the two cars, and you won't have that same kind of problem. And the other real factor, which is true certainly for freight equipment too, is making sure that you're not putting in reverse curves, which have the same kind of effect.
Right.
And that, you know, whereas you might get away with 6 or 8 inches in between curves in the opposite direction of straight track, if it's freight equipment, again, if you've got that 85-foot passenger car and it's coming off a curve that's in one direction and going onto a curve that's the other direction, you better give it a good 12 inches to straighten out and
right.
Hit it the other way.
Right. Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, that answered small letter A pretty well. So I'll go to B then, unless there was more you wanted to address on the curves.
Well, B is turnouts.
Yeah, so that's why I was going to go to B, yeah.
Question. And yeah, same principle. The real trick is that a crossover especially is a built-in reverse curve. So if you've got double track, which is pretty typical for passenger operations, and you've got a number six to a number six, that's a pretty stiff reverse curve. So if you can go to number eight or even bigger, it's going to really, it's certainly going to look better, and it's probably going to be a lot more reliable.
Right, right. Very good. So, as I put there, so yeah, that would mean snap switches are pretty much out of the question.
I wouldn't go with snap.
if I did that, I'd have Jim Lincoln and Craig Biscayer come after me with tar and feathers anyway. Now, one of the things I feel like people may not give a thought to is storage track length.
Well, that's you know, always important. I mean, I think that's actually something of an advantage for passenger operations, because if you think about it, I did a little math. I'm not that good at it. I did a little math before we started. Imagine an 8-car passenger train with a locomotive. In HO, that probably can fit into about 9 feet.
Okay.
And in the same space, you might get 13 50-foot freight cars on a locomotive. But you think about an 8-car passenger train is pretty impressive on a model railroad. That looks like a mainline passenger train, whereas a 13-car freight train is not really that impressive, at least for the modern era. So in some ways you can operate passenger trains that I think feel more prototypical.
Right. Odd how, you know, it's funny because when you said that in the recording before, I never even thought of that, but you're right. For some reason, the that 8-car passenger train to the eye, that looks really long, and I never even thought of that before. So then, with those questions underway, I'm going to have to ask my where to start question. I mean, sometimes it may seem obvious to some, but I'll still ask, where's a good place to start?
Well, you know, I was thinking that we have something that poor John Armstrong never had, which is things like Google Maps and Bing Maps. And if someone's really interested in learning about passenger facilities and the kind of trackage and track arrangements that prototype big city passenger terminals use, all you have to do is go to Google Maps and look at something like Union Station here in Washington, or Sunnyside Yard up in Long Island, or Chicago, or any place like that, and see what's going on there. And so that's a great way to get a feel for it. Now, in the case of the model railroader plan that I did for Mark Goldstein, he had a treasure trove of historical track charts and schematics and things for that Toronto terminals area that he wanted to model. And so I was able to look and see not only what it looks like now, but what it looked like in the era that Mark wanted to model, which was more in the 70s and early 80s, where Spadina Yard was in operation. And he had this thing he sent me that was Spadina Yard in 1945 or something like that. And it took up about 4 8.5 by 11 sheets just to fit this diagram. So that really was, gave me a good idea of what flavor he was going for, and a lot of the actual features of the prototype that I could copy and steal to make the plan feel right.
Nice. Great. And then it was smaller B. Now, of course, you already mentioned Google Maps, but any other particular book or internet resource that you would think of in this case?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm sure there are some good ones. Again, I mentioned John Armstrong's Track Planning for Realistic Operations.
Oh, yeah.
Still in print. And he definitely spends a number of pages on passenger operations and the special considerations you need to have for reliable operation of long equipment like passenger equipment.
Nice. Well, as I look at section three in Keys to, where I titled Keys to Designing, what were some of the key things you knew that this layout for Mr. Goldstein or Goldstein, please forgive us, needed to include?
Well, Mark was apologetic when he contacted me and said, I know we can't fit all this in, but here's what I really want. And so I gave it the old college try. But, some of it was sort of spoke for itself, but he definitely wanted a representation of the Toronto passenger terminal. And he wanted the kind of complicated yard throat that I gave him, which is in itself, it's cut down quite a bit from the real thing, but it's still got a bunch of double slip switches and crossovers and things like that. So he really wanted to do that kind of complicated yard throat. And then he wanted a representation of Spadina Yard Terminal outside of that. And the funny thing is, and I think I wrote about this a little in the article, I visited Toronto in the 80s when this was still in place. Right now it's got big sports arenas where it used to be. But the CN Tower sits right above, guess what? What used to be the yards there. And I remember going up in the CN Tower and looking down and seeing these yards just stretching out as far as you could see in other, in both directions. And one of the things that I really wanted to try to get in if I could is the balloon tracks, because, you know, they say there's a prototype for everything. And of course, return loops are generally considered unprototypical, except passenger yards where they use them to turn entire consists of passenger trains. So I was able to get a return loop in there, which sort of gave the flavor. And if you're looking at the model railroader plan, the return loop sort of makes a big loop around the turntable just like it did at Spadina. So I was kind of pleased with how that came out.
You gotta love it when that kind of thing. It's
sometimes
funny.
Things just work.
It's true. I had to laugh, and they told me to go off script here, but there was somebody on Facebook a little while ago talked about the unprototypical nature of return loops. And like, and in all in good fun, and within probably like 15 minutes, he had been slammed with pictures of return, two of which I provided. There's like two or three of them right here in South Jersey.
Sure.
For freight.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they're all over the place.
But, yeah.
It was great to get that in there. And then, given that we had this big terminal and this big yard, we really needed enough main line to sort of make it make sense. And I figured, the way Toronto works is going southwest from Toronto proper, sort of along the shores of Lake Ontario. The main line there is pretty straight, but it goes through a series of commuter stations. And then there are a couple of stations where the long distance trains will stop as well. So I figured I wanted to get in enough main line to make the terminal makes sense, and at least a couple stations where you could stop trains as you were doing the operations, and then at the other end to have enough of a staging yard so again you could have a lot of trains ready to do a morning rush and an evening rush and be able to model that kind of frequency and in that space.
Great, fantastic. All right, so you talked about some of the things, and Mark, I tell you what, Mark seems to have gone into this to doing his homework from everything you said, so that's pretty cool.
It's, I when I'm working with different folks, some of them are, really happily freelance, and they sort of say whatever you want to do, and then others, oh no, it's got to be just as close as we can possibly get to the real thing. And
gotcha. Well, Bob, in small letter B of three, in a multi-track layout, because I'm pretty sure I noticed, I think he has a double track layout for this, but in any case, whether he does or doesn't, how does that change things?
Well, it actually doesn't change things as much as you might think. Mm-hmm. And John Armstrong again pointed out that in a smaller layout, sometimes double track's a great choice because you think about a curve, which is the biggest thing that we have to allow for in track planning is the turn back curve. Mm. And if you've got a 30 inch curve, that's 60 inches across and you need a few inches on either side for room for the trains to fall over without falling to the floor. Okay, add a parallel curve at 32 inches, you're really only adding 4 inches of width there, and you're getting double the operation. So in some ways, if it'll fit as a single track, it'll almost fit as a double track in the same space. Obviously, there's some things like, in a single track scheme, you're looking to balance out the runs of single track between towns or between passing sidings so that you've got enough challenge so that it's fun to operate and it's not too frustrating to get trains by one another. Whereas in a double track layout, you're sort of assuming that the trains will be more frequent and you'll have fun because you've got a lot more action going on, but the interaction of the trains with each other, they don't have to do the same kind of meets and passes that they would in a single track situation. So it's just sort of thinking through some of that stuff, and you can get a little complicated when you're designing a yard because you have to think about, as opposed to a single track main line, your arrival and departure tracks just branch right off and there you go. And the double track, what if the train's on the other side and it needs to get over to the yard? You need to have enough crossovers and enough space so that the yard can service both eastbound and the westbound tracks, or sometimes you can put the yard in between the eastbound and westbound tracks, which is what the prototype often did on the larger yard facilities. But that can get tricky to make sure that the access is all there to go from wherever you want to go on the main line to wherever you want to go in the yard.
Gotcha. I mean, the one thing I had thought of was you know, in terms of a minimum radius, you have to make sure that I guess what it does is the one area I thought that might be a little bit of a challenge is like if I want a 30-inch minimum radius, I have to make sure that it's that inside track that's the 30-inch minimum radius. Otherwise, I'm shrinking that down to like say maybe a 28 or a 27 even.
Right, right. The other thing about long cars, of course, is that even on a relatively broad curve like a 30-inch, they still overhang somewhat. And if you put a 30-inch curve and a 32-inch curve concentrically to give yourself the double track, you still might get some side swiping. So it's
right.
Usually better to increase that to 32 1/4 inches or 32 1/8 inches or something like that. And it's a darn good idea to mock it up and test it out with your longest equipment and make sure you're not going to be side swiping yourself when you have trains going in opposite directions.
Bob, I still remember the old days when I thought a 22-inch curve was a big radius curve. And, yeah, I remember one time, and I have to hand it to myself. I mean, I had everything measured out precisely, and I had those 22-inch curves, you know, precisely, I forget what it was, 2 inches, the track centers. And it looked, you know, for my 40-foot box cars, it was great. And then I was like, well, let me run my GG1 with a passenger. Oh, no.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so. All right. Well, in small letter C, fitting in the long run, I am a huge fan of being sincere. But in a limited space, what are some options? Because I know some people like those mileage makers.
Yeah, well, you know, if all you really want to do is get the main line as long as it can possibly be and you don't worry too much about the scenic effect of that. You know, people have pointed out that when you're operating, your focus is so much on your train that you may not even notice what's going on 2 feet away. And there's certainly some fine layouts that do not follow the rules in that regard. I was kind of pleased because I think the solution I came up with for Mark was pretty good because, you know, I call it sort of a semi-mushroom plan.
Yes.
And it was interesting because, you know, you take that 30-inch minimum radius in Mark's room and it just barely fit in the wider part of the room, leaving enough room for an aisle on either side of it. And if we'd had the same arrangement, the yard and the terminal, there would have been almost no main line left at that point.
Mm.
Instead, you know, we created the thing where Spadina and the Toronto terminal are on an upper level that you actually climb up a couple of stairs and stand on a raised platform to operate. So it's still at a comfortable operating height. And then, you know, as you go west exiting out of Spadina, you spiral down a helix and wind up at floor level, actually under Spadina Yard there for a while, and it adds another, you know, 20, 25 feet worth of main line, which really made the whole scheme work as far as I was concerned.
Ah, very cool. Excellent. And of course, the multi-deck is always, if you want to be sincere, but you want a mainline run, I guess the multi-deck is also the other option that can be taken. All right. D, then, taking grades in, I'm guessing helices is the plural of helixes, but I think I was
sure. Helices, but.
There you go, helices. There we go, that works. Do model passenger trains handle that sort of thing different or even drastically different than, say, a freight?
I think, you know, and we talked about how in some ways a shorter passenger train is, works on a model railroad better than a shorter freight train. So, you know, given the same weight per car, you might actually be better off with the passenger. And I think, you know, especially Mark's in the diesel era, on his railroad, and diesels are usually pretty well weighted, so if you got a couple diesels pulling even an 8-car train, you're probably in pretty good shape on reasonable grades. You'd want to be careful about, you know, a steam consist, you know, making sure that a single steam locomotive can pull your heavyweight passenger cars up the grades that you're planning.
Mm.
And that's just experimentation, but certainly something to be thought about. And the other thing for helix construction is the same thing we talked about with the parallel or concentric curves, that if your inner radius is 30 inches, your outer radius probably ought to be 32 and a quarter or even bigger to make sure that you're not getting sideswiping.
Right. And what was, if you remember, in this little script, what was the radius of Mark's helix?
It's a 30 on the inside and 32 plus on the outside.
Okay, all right. And then just folks got to be prepared because that's going to be a, a 5.5 foot diameter circle that's basically going to be in the room.
Sure. It's the good thing is, you get the fair amount of scenery on the top level. The way it works out, so it's not, a big wasted blob in the middle of the room.
Right. Very good. Then for terminal and station essentials, because, if you're running passenger trains, they kind of do need somewhere to go. And oftentimes, I just think of – one of my complaints has always been on many model railroads, including my own in the past, that the buildings just aren't big enough. Mm-hmm. And I feel like oftentimes, we'll see a station – simple station, maybe two platforms. But, in a typical town, in typical town station areas, design and track-wise, what do you think we actually really should be seeing?
Well, I think you're right about the size. You've seen the train, the station on a model railroad where the train platform is, 40 feet long and the, coast daylight comes through and there'd be absolutely no way for the passengers to get onto most of the train because it's hanging off so far on both sides. And, we tried to make the terminal in Toronto long enough so that the platforms would really accommodate a full-length passenger train that way. So that makes for a pretty darn good-sized passenger station, even though the station itself is on the backdrop. So I think that's important. And some of the other things that, whether they're essential or not, certainly make things a lot more interesting is to have the facilities you need to do the servicing and the turning of passenger trains from a decent sized coach yard, which needs to be designed to be flexible in operation, just like a freight yard, and engine servicing facilities and car washing facilities and all kinds of things like that that give you the rationale for doing some real interesting operations around the terminal in the yard.
Right. It is interesting because even like, but there's still a, I'm getting some weird feedback. There's a few stations extant here on the Millville line that I'm modeling, which is freight only for now. Well, actually, they'll be restoring some passenger service back to it in a couple of years. Seems to be more a matter of when, not if anymore. Mm-hmm. But there's still quite a few old stations. Well, I say quite a few. There's like three or so old stations still on the line. And yet, while you could tell the stations themselves are relatively small buildings, even they seem to have more platform length than what you might see typically represented on a model railroad. So,
well, you figure, an 85-foot car in HO is a foot long.
Right.
So even if you're running four or five car trains, that means you need a station platform that's 4 or 5 feet long if it's really going to match that kind of thing. I mean, there certainly are and were stations where the platform didn't accommodate the whole train.
Right.
But it's pretty rare to see one that, at least, for any kind of modern era train that doesn't accommodate at least 4 or 5 cars to allow the passengers on and off in a relatively short order.
Right, that makes sense. Well, then, and you talked about some of the essentials, but I guess just to fill in any gaps, I'm thinking of terminals and big stations. What do the trains need to be able to do? And I guess I'm asking that in the relationship of, I was just looking at the multiples of turnouts at the throats of these terminals. I mean, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, there is. And you've got to have an appetite for building that kind of thing, which Mark did. And it's going to be very impressive when it's done, I think, to have all those double slips and everything. Basically, if you look at the layout, which is somewhat compressed, certainly from the prototype, but not that much from the way the Toronto station is today, is you know, what it's giving the operators the opportunity to do is to take any train from any incoming track and put it on any station track or vice versa. And there are also some sort of parallel routes so that, you know, a train can be coming in one direction and a train can be leaving at the same time. And then there's multiple options so that they don't have to wait for each other. Because, you know, at rush hour at any big city terminal, and this is still true in places like Toronto and Washington, D.C. and New York and Boston, is that you've got trains leaving every 5 or 10 minutes or coming in at the same time. And if they all would had to wait for each other, it would be very, very inefficient. So so there's sort of multiple routes that allow a train to get in and get out without interfering with the trains that are already there or the ones that are coming in the other direction.
Right. Right. You know, it's interesting because I guess I'm thinking the same principles that I do of the when I'm modeling a freight yard. And one of the things that I'm erring on the side of with modeling my Pavonia freight yard is taking away one or two of the classifying tracks in order to have one, more than simply two arrival departure tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And that is like our yards, it's the one area of our railroad that's really handled in real time. And I would imagine it's probably very similar with a big terminal like what Mark will have.
Yeah, that's right. It's you're not really compressing the time that it takes to get in and out of the terminal station because you're going to be operating at a relatively slow speed. And to get the kind of operation that, that he wants to simulate, you're going to want to have a number of trains coming in and going out during a relatively short actual span of time. So so he needs that much flexibility in his track, and I think it's going to be a heck of a lot of fun to operate. And so we tried to set it up so that we could feed it enough with trains coming in off the main line and even some auxiliary tracks. I stuck a couple of substandard radius staging tracks inside the helix on the top level so that it wouldn't have a very long run, but you can definitely stage a couple of trains on this branch and have them come into the mix right along with everything else and have to be sorted and brought into the passenger station. So that'll be a lot of variety.
Oh yeah, that sounds like that does sound. Where's he modeling again? I gotta go see this guy sometime.
Yeah, I forget whether I want to say he's in Wisconsin, but I'm not entirely sure about that.
Excellent, excellent. Trying to get there's something else I was going to ask. Oh, so and is he going to actually handle a lot of those turnouts, or did he say whether he was? Just out of curiosity.
I get the impression he's a fast tracks devotee like you and me.
Gotcha.
Certainly would be an expensive throat to build if you had to pay $50 for each double slip switch or something. So
I was looking at that and I can't remember how many double slips I counted in that yard throat, but I'm sure there was a good amount.
I'd say there are nine of those plus a goodly number of standard turnouts as well. So you could certainly bring the cost per unit down quite a bit if you're going to build them with the fast tracks fixtures.
Nice, very nice. Bob, is there anything that we haven't asked that we should have asked about this?
Oh boy, no. I think we covered a lot of the things that went into the plan, and it was a lot of fun to design. Mark he's working on it. He hasn't, I've seen some pictures within the past few months of, bench work going up and things like that. So I really do hope he is able to get it to a state where it's operational pretty soon and we can see how it works.
Oh, fantastic. And, do you know offhand if you have any more articles coming up in MR anytime soon?
They have bought another couple, for sure that are in their library now. So,
oh, fantastic.
Don't as usual know when they're going to run them, but you know, they usually come out fairly soon for me.
Great. Oh, fantastic. Well, Bob, thanks so much for coming on and, talking with us. I'm looking for, I definitely going to get you on the show again soon. And if I don't see you before then, I'm looking forward to seeing you at the MARPM.
Yeah. I hope you can come down for the the whole thing. Hope that that's a possibility for you. And
yeah,
certainly hope a lot of other model rail casters will make their way to Fredericksburg, because it really has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've got, what's nice is my sister just moved down there last year. So I've got she actually lives in Haymarket.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. So not too far away from the, Marpham. I think it was like about a 45 minute drive or so. So
that's probably about right.
Yeah. So great.
Norfolk Southern runs right through Haymarket.
Right.
Beautiful, beautiful countryside out there. And the, got the added benefit of having trains running through it once in a while.
Always good benefit.
Well, that was one of the first plans that I did that Model Railroader published, was based on the Norfolk Southern B line, sort of starting at Manassas and heading out through Haymarket and Gainesville and eventually to Front Royal. So that was probably 10 years ago or so, but it was based on that area of the country.
Now, do you get to do you ever get pictures back of guys who show you that, hey, look, I did build it?
I've gotten a few. Yeah, I've got a guy who's working. He's actually getting a lot of the layout built professionally. I think he's gonna do the scenery himself. But he sent me some pictures just the other day, and I said, wow, it really is. You know, it's one thing when you get a professional working on it, I guess 8 hours a day, you can really make some his progress, but it was really shaping up.
Oh, nice. And I believe, didn't you design for Tom Jacobs? And I know he's plugging away.
Yeah, he certainly is. It's interesting. We got it to the point where he could start building it, and I still haven't really finished the upper levels of the plan. If you're listening, Tom, send me the rest of the promised, and we'll get it designed and up on the website so people can take a look, because yeah, that's another one that's come out, I think, very nice. It's going to be a lot of fun to operate, and he's working away.
I know that one of the toughest enigma for me in designing my second level is that I have been swayed. I don't want people doubling back on themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if so, and on the Millville line, it runs from, it's a north-south line. So I'm trying to make the same, but it's like, man, if I were to actually double back and run the wrong way, then the way I can fit the towns in goes much better. So it's been a really, really tough enigma design-wise, because I really don't want to break that rule.
But, well, you know, rules are made to be broken. I think sometimes you just, you know, I've broken them all one time or another, you know, it's an art of compromise. We don't have infinite room, and we're trying to things that are way bigger than we can really represent. And, right. You know, the best thing, and I know you've done a fair amount of this, and I've done more and more, is to get out and run.
Oh yeah.
These railroads, you just learn a lot. And I, you know, there's nothing will convince you of the value of wide enough aisles than operating at a railroad that doesn't have wide enough aisles. You know, things like that, and you know, good access. You know, just operate on a railroad where the access isn't good, and you'll
understand.
Definitely want to pay attention to it from there on out.
I know when I designed this one, and it's funny because I've even changed since then, except since I have 75% of the bench work up for the first level. That's kind of what it is. But for me, it was a 3 foot minimum. And now I'm thinking, you know, I mean, I'm glad I did that, but probably 4 foot would have been even better.
But it's, you know, you can never be too rich or too thin, and you can never have aisles wide enough, I think.
Yep. So, well, Bob, thanks so much for your time, and we really appreciate it. And we look forward to getting some updates from you, and looking forward to the Marpham. So thanks for giving us your time tonight.
Tim, it's been a pleasure as always. And anytime I can be of service, just let me know.
All right. Thank you.
And, of course, what we open the show with, we close the show with. The Model Railcast theme. Till next time, guys.
You've been listening to The Model Railcast Show. You can find us at www.modelrailcastshow.com or on Facebook at Friends of MRCS. And look for us on iTunes. Don't miss your other great model railroading podcasts out there. The Scotty Mason Show, Model Rail Radio, A Modeler's Life, and the Model Railroad Hobbyist Podcast, and drop us a line if we miss mentioning you. This is Amy Perkins for the Model Railcast Show. Have a great week.